From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, the site of last week's deadly school shooting, are heading to the state capital, Tallahassee, today, where they'll meet with legislators and hold a rally tomorrow. Their goal is to convince lawmakers to institute stronger gun laws, including banning assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Student Charlotte Dwyer hid in the Douglas Auditorium for 2 hours during the shooting rampage. Here she is talking to NBC News.
They need to understand the pain that we've gone through, the pain that the families who lost someone are going through, and so they can create laws that will not allow anyone, whether you're mentally ill or not, to purchase these guns that can kill hundreds in a matter of minutes.
But not all legislators agree that gun restrictions are the way to ensure safety. Joining us now is State Senator Greg Stube. He's chair of the Florida Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And you've got a busload of students arriving today in Tallahassee. They're demanding stronger gun laws. What do you want to tell them?
Yeah, I think the students are coming up this evening and trying to meet with members tomorrow. I mean, one of the things that I've tried to do in the state of Florida since 2013 after Sandy Hook was put a program in place called a school safety program that would allow individuals who work at our schools that go through a rigorous training program that are former current law enforcement, former current military, in good standing, go through background checks, go through active shooter training, go through all the things that school resource officers go through to be able to carry during their time of employment at the schools. And unfortunately, we haven't been able to get that done. But I think with what the overall package that the governor, the Senate leaders, and the House leaders are working on, we'll have some piece of that included in it.
You think there should be more guns in schools?
I believe that properly trained individuals can stop terrorists and assailants from walking into a school and wreaking havoc for 5 to 7 minutes before law enforcement gets there. Yeah, absolutely.
And what evidence do you point to show that that's the case?
Every single mass shooting that's occurred in the state of Florida has been in a gun-free zone. Pulse nightclub, gun-free zone. And it took law enforcement 3.5 hours to get into the Pulse nightclub. 3.5 hours while our citizens hided behind urinals and bathrooms and lay on the floor waiting for medical treatment because law enforcement didn't go in the building, and that was a gun-free zone. Florida State University, Fort Lauderdale Airport, and now Parkland. It's not a coincidence. If you look at some of these people that commit these heinous acts and you read some of the things that they've written about their plans, like the Dark Knight shooter out in Colorado, if you read his journal, he did a lot of research on what movie theaters he wanted to attack. There were 8 movie theaters within a 4-mile radius of his home. There was one movie theater that didn't allow patrons to carry concealed firearms, and that's the one movie theater that he attacked. So there's a ton of evidence to show that this is where people like this want to go and create mass chaos, and they're going to try to do it in a place where they know law-abiding citizens aren't caring.
What do you say to people, though, who believe that, in fact, fewer guns is the answer to this, and they look at a place like Australia where the gun homicide rate and gun suicide rate plummeted by 42% and 57% after the country enacted new firearm restrictions?
Well, I've seen data that's the opposite of that. After they first instituted those restrictions, armed robberies escalated, homicides escalated, because now the criminals had firearms and the law-abiding citizens didn't. I would just say the facts are pretty well taken. In the state of Florida, we have concealed carry permit holders, and we've had that for 28 years. Concealed license permit holders are 10 times less likely to commit a misdemeanor or a felony than certified law enforcement officers. So if you're okay with a police officer carrying a gun and walking around with a gun on his hip, you should be 10 times more okay with a concealed license permit holder carrying a gun in a concealed manner and walking about wherever he's walking about in the state of Florida, because they're 10 times less likely to commit a crime. Why wouldn't you want somebody like that? And in our schools that would have to go through a series and litany of training programs, current former law enforcement, current former military, in good standing to be able to defend our children.
Do you think as part of what you're proposing that there should also be more restrictions on guns in any way, or stronger background checks, stuff like that?
Well, you're required right now to get background checks. Federal law requires you to get a background check, just like a background check was committed on this assailant in the Parkland case, just like a background check was committed on the shooter at the Pulse nightclub.
Well, obviously it didn't
work. Unfortunately, it worked in the sense they didn't have a criminal history. So if there's, and they didn't have an adjudication of mentally ill. So if there's things that we can do to try to ensure that people like this don't get firearms, there's going to have to be a way to do it that goes into the criminal history background checks. But the background checks were done in both these cases.
Do you expect that there are going to be new gun control measures, either in Florida or nationally as a result of what we just saw?
Well, the overall package, it was recently reported in the news from our Senate leadership, some of the things that they were looking at doing. They were looking at putting some more money into mental health counselors and mental health funding in the state of Florida, which I've said for years is abysmally low. We rank 49th and 50th out of the country in mental health funding. I think that's something that we can do. There's also a lot of discussion about putting some more money in school hardening so that our schools can spend some resources to make sure that there's one entry and exit point and people like this can't just walk onto a campus and start shooting. So I think there's a lot of things like that. They're going to be in the overall package that you'll probably see released next week.
That's State Senator Greg Stube of Florida. Senator, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Let's go to California now, where drought conditions could bring about new restrictions on water use. Ranchers and environmentalists often take different views on such rules. In fact, they don't always agree on how to address a range of environmental impacts because policies meant to protect the environment can mean restrictions on where ranchers can graze their herds. But one rancher and a popular outdoor brand hope to make ranching both green and profitable. Capital Public Radio's Ezra David Romero reports.
Lonnie Estelle's family ranches on thousands of acres in Modoc County on the border of Nevada and California. We're in a field surrounded by sheep looking out on a place called Surprise Valley.
Right now they're just eating and living life, just happy.
It's a beautiful, almost forgotten place where the West still lives. That's the county's motto. Very few industries besides agriculture exist here.
There's a lot that goes into this. It's really hard to run a business this size.
That struggle got a little easier around 4 years ago when Estelle got a call from a woman named Rebecca Burgess. Burgess worked with a regional textile group called Fibershed, and she asked Estelle to ranch in a way that would benefit the environment and preserve her lifestyle.
To be able to do that, they needed an economy to be stable enough to retain their way of life.
It took a bit of arm twisting for the family to get on board because of previous encounters with environmentalists.
Ranchers have been threatened constantly by the environmental community, so we had to kind of open up our minds a little bit to accept what was being offered as a genuine offer.
They finally accepted, and with help and funds from the Natural Resources Conservation Service, they created an environmentally friendly farm plan called a carbon farm plan.
Climate-friendly farming, I would say, is just being aware of the soil.
It was a new thing because very few people ranch in a sustainable way in Modoc County. Estelle says she gets questions from ranchers who don't believe in climate change. She responds by saying,
"So you don't believe in global warming and climate change? Okay. What about your riparian zones? What about your soil that is now full of worms and producing more grass than it did before? Just why not?"
Estelle is talking about farm practices that take carbon out of the air and suck it into the ground. Too much carbon in the air is a bad thing because it warms the atmosphere. But in soil, it's a plus because it releases nutrients for plants and boosts soil health. Today, the family has help in the form of grants, and there are now 5 carbon farming practices in play on the ranch. Perhaps the most visible is composting.
Got my shovel. That's pretty good stuff. Still got some wood chips, but the manure's all decomposed down.
Now the Estelle's ranch takes the equivalent of 850 cars worth of carbon dioxide out of the air and into the ground. When the popular outdoor brand The North Face heard about the carbon farm plan, it offered to help the ranch with more grants. The end result? A climate-friendly beanie using wool from the ranch.
It's unbelievably soft. It's unbelievably warm.
James Rogers is Director of Sustainability for The North Face. He says this year, the brand is expanding the line to a scarf and jacket using Estelle's wool.
You're trying to reduce the negative impact of a product, and that's what got us so excited about this initiative.
We're at Warner Mountain Weavers in Cedarville, California, where a woman is making a blue and white striped rug on a loom. This is where Estelle and her friends sell and create their products.
To our right, you'll see the Lonnie's Lana corner, where I've got various different weights of yarn.
For Estelle, the partnership has given her a second chance at life. The volume of wool the North Face buys allows her to get her wool into larger mills at wholesale rates. She hopes the partnership opens the door for other ranchers in Modoc County.
I definitely feel blessed. It's taking what's in your storehouse and making that a plus. I think that this area has the potential to be a small manufacturing area because the cost of living is less.
Estelle's already developed a second line called Community Supported Cloth, sold in 3 stores. She wants to get that number up to 9. For Here and Now, I'm Ezra David Romero in Modoc County, California.
As lovers of stop-motion animation know, Nick Park and the Aardman Animation Studios are back. Park is the Oscar-winning director of Creature Comforts, as well as the Wallace and Gromit films The Curse of the Were-Rabbit, A Close Shave, and The Wrong Trousers, all of which featured hapless inventor Wallace, who seems to always need the rescue of his faithful dog, Gromit.
It's the wrong trousers, Gromit, and they've gone wrong. Stop them, Gromit! Stop them!
Well, now Nick Park is taking on prehistoric times. His new film is called Early Man, and it pits Bronze Age against Stone Age in an epic game of soccer. Or, of course, as the rest of the world calls it, football. As we hear in this scene, the stakes are high for the cavemen and women.
The leader of the Bronze People, he says if we play this game and beat them at it...
Ooh, nice tight shots.
Oh, Mum.
We can have our valley back. That's what we want.
And if we don't beat them?
Then, he said, we'll spend the rest of our miserable lives working down a mine.
No!
What's a mine?
Early Man is in theaters now, and Nick Park joins us to talk about it. Nick Park, welcome to Here and Now.
Oh, great to be here, Meghna. Thanks.
So I hear that this movie, Early Man, has been on your mind since 2010. What put the idea in your head first?
Well, I think it was all a lot of these ideas. They start with just a drawing and a sketch pad or a sketchbook, a doodle. And with this, I remember I was just drawing your typical caveman with a club hitting a rock. And I just started to think about sport, and particularly soccer came to mind. That's kind of the religion in Europe, and just how tribal it is, really. And it just seemed to suit the whole idea of primitive people.
Well, I was going to say that the behavior of some soccer fans is kind of cavemanish, but that might be an insult to cavemen. It's a remarkable conceit, right? The film that you have these prehistoric people living contemporaneously with those in the Bronze Age fighting on the soccer pitch. But I hear that you yourself perhaps aren't the biggest soccer fan.
I have to admit this, I'm not really a soccer fan. I didn't really grow up in a soccer fan family. My hometown is Preston, which the local team is Preston North End. And I had a Preston North End school bag, but I never ever went to see a game. But I guess being a non-soccer fan, I was really trying to make just an entertaining, family comedy that happens to have soccer as a kind of a, an underdog prehistoric sports movie. And so it's really the soccer that gave it the kind of the funny angle, really.
So I'm something of a soccer fan myself, which is why I had several laugh out loud moments in this movie. And I'm not going to give away too much, but there's a nod to the 1966 World Cup buried in there that England won.
Yes.
And the theatrics that Premier League players will do when they get legally tackled. Those were definitely laugh out loud moments for me. But can we play a little clip from the film here? This is a scene from Early Man. The caveman team gets a little help from Guna. She is a soccer loving young woman from the Bronze Age who is not allowed to play on the hallowed ground by virtue of her gender. But she does end up helping the caveman team. They're confused by how much she actually knows about the game. So let's listen.
So what formation do you normally play?
Formation?
4-4-2 or 4-3-3. Who's your sweeper? Do you man mark or plays only?
We just kick the ball about and chase it.
Now, Gouda was voiced by Maisie Williams. She's of Game of Thrones fame, right? You've also got Eddie Redmayne in there and Tom Hiddleston, so quite a cast.
Yeah, fantastic. And Timothy Spall and Richard Ayoade, who you just heard there. Many known in the UK who were just my favourite comedians and actors.
So let me ask you, Nick, if I may, this is the first film in a while, I think, or at least, correct me if I'm wrong, where basically every character, your first Aardman film, that every character, except for one or two key ones, is human. And I'm wondering how much of a change that was, because people know your work from, you know, Wallace and Gromit, from Chicken Run, all these wonderful films where animals play huge roles, but this felt a little different. Why'd you do that?
I've never thought about it like that, because the animal characters tend to be human, really.
Right.
You know, they've got kind of animal costumes on. Gromit, for example, even though he's a dog, he'd be very insulted if you treated him like a dog. I guess there's Hognob, he's Doug's pet pig, who's had great fun with. But I never thought of it, actually, because in Chicken Run, I guess, I tend to think of them as human beings. But yeah, they are chickens. You've reminded me.
You mentioned Hognob, who definitely is a key character here. Do we get to say who voiced him?
That was me. It was accidental. I didn't even apply for the job. We do scratch voices, you know, just temporary voices, temporary music. And I was always doing Hognob just for a laugh, really. And when it came to casting, the producer and the editor and some of my colleagues said, well, we've grown to like the way you do him. So I got the part.
Can you give us one of Hognob's lines?
Oh, gosh, I've just got to get in character a bit here. It's a sort of like a Scooby-Doo, but with a slightly more gravel, really.
And he has considerable talents, which, again, I'm not going to give away because people should go see this film. So, Nick, can I just step back a little bit here? Because you have possibly one of the most unique careers in animation. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, if, for people who don't know the story, how did you first get into, you know, stop-motion plasticine animation?
I always loved drawing cartoons, and I loved to make people laugh with my cartoons. And also, by the way, which is kind of pertinent to this film, I was a big Ray Harryhausen fan. I was obsessed with dinosaurs. And 1 Million Years BC was one of my favourite films when I was 11 or 12 years old. And actually, that is the film that made me pick up my mother's home movie, Bell and Howell home movie camera, and it had a single frame button on it, so I could do stop motion. And so I made sort of plasticine dinosaurs and characters and started animating them. Wow. And I tried different techniques as well. I wasn't really convinced that I was going to be a stop motion animator until a clay animator until later. But I was influenced by Terry Gilliam's paper cutout animation, various kinds, really. And by the time I went to art school and then film school, I started making my own character, you know, making Wallace and Gromit, actually.
You know, I suppose I should ask you, I just breezed right over this, but I should ask you, can you describe a little bit about how you and the animators at Aardman do what they do, right? Because you're shooting frame by frame, you know, on a set that is, it's three-dimensional. How does it work? How do you make these characters come to life?
It's a traditional technique, the same that Ray Harryhausen used, in fact, for his dinosaurs and creatures, where we build a figure. These days we put a metal armature or a skeleton inside, which helps you to move the character. And the animator's job, basically, is to, you know, you have your character in front of the camera, and you move each limb of the character, or the eyes, or the face, in small increments, and take a picture, move it again, take a picture, and so forth. And when you've done 24 of those, you've got 1 second of film in the can.
And so a good day is how many seconds?
Oh, 2 or 3 seconds one animator will accomplish.
Wow.
That means on our movie, like if we did a minute a week with our 35, 40 animators, that was a good week.
Wow. So here comes the inevitable question about digital technology. Because what I love about what you and the animators at Aardman do is that it's so defiantly analog, right? Don't take offense at that. I'm saying that in the most complimentary way.
Yes.
In an age where digital animation has come so far, and it too now is lush and beautiful and has great depth. So are you sort of standing out there with your lonely flag in the real world and saying, I will never go digital? Or do you sometimes feel the pull?
Aardman does actually indulge in CG from time to time. In this film, we had to go digital with, stadium full of thousands of people, or, volcanoes and lava and stuff that's just quite difficult to do with clay. But I am at heart a clay man, and I actually wanted to encourage the animators to kind of embrace the sort of earthiness of it all, because they're cavemen and the thumbprints and the fur that's slightly, even if the fur slightly sort of, you can do beautiful fur with CG, of course. But I like that quality that the early King Kong film has, where the fur twitches a little bit all the time because the animator's handling it for every frame of the film.
Mm-hmm. Well, Doug's hair definitely has that twitchy quality.
So
it seems that there's no shortage of work for Aardman and the style of animation that you do.
No, it's incredible. I mean, a few years ago when CGI was really coming to the fore, deservedly so, we thought, how many days do we have left? How many years? But it seems to be, it's flowering still, it's flourishing. As long as we all keep telling good stories with compelling characters, then it why shouldn't it, really?
Absolutely. Well, Nick Park is the Oscar-winning animator and director and producer of the new film Early Man. It's in theaters now. Nick Park, such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Great to speak with you, Meghna. Thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. A new year has begun, and if you are setting new goals for your business, you need the right people on your team. And ZipRecruiter has transformed how you find them. ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 job boards with just one click, then actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Walmart, the world's largest retailer, reported today that its sales rose over the holiday shopping season if you look at in-store sales. Its growth online slowed down, and the company says operational challenges are responsible. Translation, Amazon. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
And is that it? It's Amazon and that's what's holding Walmart back?
It's online sales. It's the shift to online sales, which A, Walmart has not been so good at, B, tend to be more profitable now than in-store sales for a lot of reasons, right? It's just easier to use and to build an online operation, and customers tend to spend more and on more expensive things. This change has happened rapidly over the last decade or so, and Walmart just hasn't sort of seen it coming as clearly as it should have, whereas Amazon is kind of eating everyone's lunch. So that's exactly what's happening. We're at a tipping point where more people are spending more money online, and it's starting to hurt Walmart.
But Walmart has certainly tried to get those online sales up. They bought the online store Jet in September 2016, and last year bought Bonobos.
Yep.
Has that been paying off?
Well, unclear yet. So Jet, they bought largely because it had an infrastructure and they wanted the guy who ran it to come and do the same sort of thing at Walmart. And he's trying to. There's no question. Bonobos is one of these newfangled types of stores that you don't really buy the stuff. You go to the store, you try everything on, and then it gets sent from a warehouse to your house. So these are cultural shifts for Walmart, right? When you look at the fact that Walmart's the world's biggest retailer, more people go into a Walmart store than pretty much do anything else in a given week. It is a hard shift for them to reconcile that with their current customer base. So for the moment, these are growing pains, but Walmart is understanding it needs to grow a lot faster in the digital online space than it's already doing.
Okay, another topic I wanted to ask you about while we have you today. Venezuela launched the pre-sale of a new cryptocurrency called the Petro, backed by oil. They've been dealing with terrible inflation in Venezuela. Is this going to work?
I don't think think so. I think this is largely about evading sanctions because it's just hard for Venezuela to get its hands on dollars. Obviously, it sells oil, but it's been selling less and less oil, producing less and less oil over time. That's where it gets its dollars from. But the currency that they use in Venezuela has been depreciating at such a rate. You and I talked about Zimbabwe trying this recently. They went for a dollar-denominated currency, and it collapsed instantly because nobody believes that there's anything backing it. In theory, this cryptocurrency, which is based on the Ethereum platform as opposed to the Bitcoin platform, is supposed to be pegged to the country's natural resources, mostly oil, but some gold and silver. In practice, it's not sure that actually works. I would wait to see what happens, but fundamentally, dealing in a cryptocurrency means they're not dealing in dollars, which means they're not subject to the sanctions that have been imposed by the United States. I think that's this effort. Building a currency is very, very hard work if you're a country that's actually working well and your economy is stable. For a country like Venezuela, which is very broken with a very broken economy, I don't think that they're really going to succeed with building a new currency.
More of a sign of desperation.
I think so.
That's Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
DJ, won't you play this girl a love song?
Marion Hodges is a DJ with KCRW in Santa Monica. She's back with us once again. Hi, Marion.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me back.
Well, thanks for coming back. And you have brought us quite a mix, as so often KCRW DJs do. But before we get started and get to that music, how do you find it?
Oh, how don't I find it? I think is the more appropriate question. We're fortunate enough to have a lot of great record label friends and publicists and whatnot send us music. There's also SoundCloud, social media, recommendations from friends. So it's, you know, it's just a whole process.
All right. Well, let's listen to some of the results of that process. This is a song called Mystery of Love. It's by Sufjan Stevens.
White noise, what an awful sound. Fumbling by Rogue River. Feel my feet above the ground.
If people recognize this song, it could be because they've seen the movie Call Me By Your Name. This song is actually nominated for an Oscar for that film.
It is, and that's the biggest reason why I decided to bring it in today. The song's been out there for a while, but it was just recently announced that it was nominated for an Oscar, and so it's always exciting to see one of your favorites move up in the world a little bit.
Well, and tell us about Sufjan Stevens.
So, I mean, you could hear there in that track, he's got this unbelievable gift with melody and these deep, incisive lyrics. And then I feel like on this track, he's diving into this, what it feels like to be in a new relationship and how great it is and how awful it is and just all that whole mix of things. And I think he just captures it so, so beautifully. And to see him take that lyrical gift and turn it so personal is really lovely.
Okay, up next we've got La Raji. This is I Can Only Bliss Out for Days.
As I look across this great creation and I reflect on the nature of its creator, I can only bliss out for days and days.
Has kind of a fuzzy quality. You can hear an organ in the background.
Oh, absolutely. It's a quintessential bedroom recording. It was originally, it was recorded in 1984 and has just been reissued by one of my favorite reissue labels, the Numero Group, and so it's out there now on vinyl and CD, but yes, it has that very DIY, you know, with like a shoestring budget, and that's part of what makes me love it so much.
And who is Laraji?
So Laraji is a really interesting character that I just now learned about. He started as a stand-up comedian and an actor. He was part of Brian Eno's Ambient series, and I never knew about him. I never knew anything about him until this month, and looking back over it, I'm just in awe because he's so up my alley.
All right, well, up next we've got Radius. This is by Daniel Avery. So the song kind of keeps going like that, right?
It does, although it's this very dark kind of industrial, meditative, almost drony kind of piece, but then it reaches its peak and it turns into this really beautiful, open, spiritual kind of experience, and then kind of gets back down into that dark, very minimal techno dance music.
And Daniel Avery is based in London. What is he known for?
He is. So he's mostly known for a more dance floor friendly kind of version of that very dark, very minimal techno dance music. But with this and with a couple of singles that he released last year, he really seems to be exploring these ambient spaces.
Okay, well, now let's go to the band Rye. This is their song Phoenix. Definitely a sucker for a good bass line. My ear just trains toward it, and just that's all I can hear and something like that. But this one's great.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely the most outwardly funky track that Rye has ever done, which is, I'm the same way. I love a good bass line. So I've been listening to this entire record a lot. It's only Rye's second record, but the reason that track is such a standout for me is exactly that bass line, and just, it's pretty awesome.
And the voice that we hear is the Canadian singer Milos, who also wrote and produced most of this latest album.
Well, Rye began as a collaboration between Milos and a really well-known Danish producer, Robin Hannibal. But now it's really just Milos and his live band, but he pretty much did the entire record himself.
Okay, well, we have time for one more, Marianne, and this is Tir Hamor. It's by the Welsh musician Gweno.
Bye.
Now, Gweno used to lead the group The Pipettes, but this is her latest solo work. What do you like about her?
I love The Pipettes. I was a huge fan of theirs. They were an indie pop band, and they just really nailed a modern girl group. But with what she's doing with her solo work, she's really moved into this ethereal, very synth-pop-focused phase, and she's committed to singing in both Welsh, as she did for her 2015 record, and on this new record, which is coming out on March 2nd, she's doing it all in Cornish, which is another very obscure Brittonic language. So I just think that's really cool about her, that she's really committed to keeping ancient languages alive.
Cornish, known for the game hen, as far as I know.
Yes.
That's Marion Hodges, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. Marion, thank you.
Thank you so much.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban has claimed responsibility for several recent attacks. And last week, the group published a letter urging Americans to press the Trump administration to withdraw from Afghanistan. The letter also repeated the Taliban's longstanding offer for direct talks with Washington. Let's bring in Patricia Gossman. She's a senior researcher on Afghanistan with Human Rights Watch and has been visiting the country since 1990, most recently just last week. Today, she joins us from Brussels. And Patricia, how can the Taliban be back in a position of such influence that it can just write an open letter like this?
Well, I think you really do have to go back to what happened after 2001. I think colleagues of mine who were there at the time, and I was also there in early 2002, I think the last thing we would have expected at that time was to be where we are now. Because the Taliban were really not just defeated, but there was an enormous sense of relief at that time about the opportunity for a new beginning, that the days of the kind of repressive Taliban rule was over and the rest of that. But that very soon changed into real concern about the way the new order was establishing itself, bringing back people who'd been responsible for so much destruction in the past, people who had, you know, fought the Taliban and been on and allies with the U.S. During its fight with the Taliban in late 2001. And then subsequently, in those years after, I think misgovernance by these warlords, officials, other people that had U.S. support really created the atmosphere, the climate for the Taliban to reemerge. Now, many Afghans now will entirely blame Pakistan, and Pakistan's role in this is critical, offering a safe haven, continued support to the Taliban. But one has to really look at the disillusionment, the sense of persecution among many by the new political order that came in after 2001. There was, you know, a lot of lip service paid to ideals like, you know, this was going to representative and it was a new democratic beginning for Afghanistan, and a lot of lip service to rights, women's rights, and so on. And I won't say that those changes didn't happen to some extent. There have been phenomenal changes since 2001, very important ones with respect to women's rights, with respect to the media, and so on. But fundamental institutions of governance were neglected. The Ministry of Interior, which oversees all the police, has been notoriously corrupt since the beginning. Many contracts moved through it. Getting a lucrative position in the ministry was ideal for many. And abuses by police, by other security forces, were never paid heed to. So people could get away. There was a sense of impunity among anyone who had power. There was land grabbing. There was corruption. The judiciary was so thoroughly corrupt that even, you know, in the U.S. side, there was an awareness from, I'd say, the mid-2000s on that they needed to address this. They needed to maybe support more traditional justice institutions, because people were bypassing the courts. It was an area where the Taliban gained traction in rural areas because nobody wanted to go to the court system where you have to pay enormous bribes.
Right.
They looked toward other means of justice. So all these things over time, and I'm not saying the Taliban are popular necessarily, but people saw themselves caught between very, at the least, a very unresponsive government or a very corrupt and abusive government officials, and the Taliban. And depending, you know, making rational choices depending on their circumstances, sometimes people would, if not support, at least be willing to accommodate the Taliban in their areas because they were faced with institutions that didn't work for them, that didn't serve their needs.
Yeah, so,
and this is where we are.
Yeah, so to that point, should Washington take the Taliban's offer for direct talks seriously, or should there be a renewed effort to truly uproot or root out this group from Afghanistan?
You cannot do the latter. There is no military solution to this conflict. And ultimately, you know, there has to be some kind of a negotiation. Now, of course, one wants that negotiation to, it'll be absolutely essential that human rights and the gains made since 2001 be protected in any kind of settlement. But I think people recognize that. And the pressure now to get the Taliban to the table using military, that's apparently what the idea is here. But the Afghan government is itself very fragmented. There's a battle of wills going on now between the president and several governors, ethnic divisions within, on the government side, between very powerful figures has, reared its head. It's a very fragile point. And I think this has to be taken into account in terms of what kind of state Afghanistan is going to have going forward. Hmm.
Patricia Gossman is a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. She's been speaking to us today from Brussels. Patricia, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.